I'm Will Hussman, 38 years old, and today is Friday, August 12th, 2022. I'm sitting here in Boise, Idaho, interviewing my mom, Cindy Wilson.
I am Cindy Wilson. I am 64 years old. Today's date is Friday, August 12th, 2022. I'm in Boise, Idaho, with my oldest son, Will Hussman.
Okay, hi, Mom. How are you?
It's good to be here with you, son.
Same here. I just want to go back 16 years in time and tell you and any listeners about the night before my wedding, right? So we had a big plan, me and you and our whole side of the family, to meet up at an exotic restaurant, right, the night before the wedding. Remember which restaurant it was?
No.
Sizzler. Sizzler. So we were going to meet up, and then, my bride-to-be and her family were going to meet up at a different restaurant. And one unusual thing that happened that night is I met my long-lost sister for the first time ever. So, she kind of burst onto the scene of our lives. And what were you thinking when she walked into the restaurant that night, the night before my wedding?
That was the culmination of a couple of months of us getting to know one another. She was born in 1979 when I was 19 years old. And I was a student at school and was not able to keep her. And so she was adopted at that time. And she was adopted it was through an agency, but I just thought I would never see her again. I chose not to see her at that time because I thought it would be a painful memory.
Yeah, now that was in the late 1970s when that happened. And I want to ask you about an aunt that you had growing up. So my grandpa, your dad, also had kind of an unusual experience with his mom. Can you just describe a little bit about that and how comfortable the family was talking about that?
Yeah, I didn't know anything about it until one day when I ran across some adoption papers that my father had been adopted by his grandmother. His sister had had him, and he was adopted by his grandmother.
I mean, it's weird to say his sister had him.
No.
but just to make it clear, so he was born to his mother, obviously, right? Mm-hmm. But she was young, right? 16 years old or so?
I'm not sure.
She was young, and it was better for her parents to raise the baby, right? Mm-hmm. So they adopted him. So they kind of grew up pretending that his mom was actually a sister.
Yeah, and none of us really knew the truth about that until I think I was in college when I found out.
How did that strike you?
There had been rumors, and we kind of talked about it. I didn't know if I should believe it until I actually saw those papers. But yeah, that was a surprise. It was very secretive.
Yeah, I imagine that's kind of par for the course around that time when in a community like you grew up in a pretty homogenous and orthodox religious community in southern Idaho. Mm-hmm. So I imagine, family dynamics outside the norm probably don't get a lot of attention in the public space.
That's true.
So similarly, your mom, you had an uncle, right, with who had a lot of additional needs, right, some special needs. And he was kind of put away, wasn't he? How did that unfold?
Yes, my uncle Dennis, when he was 6 years old, my mother was 8 at the time, and my grandparents also had a baby, and he was mentally challenged, and he actually hurt my mother by throwing a rock at her, and the doctor told my grandparents they had to take him to a facility. It was a hospital. It was called a mental hospital in Nampa, and that's where he lived his life, basically.
Wow.
And I didn't know anything about him for many years. I knew my grandmother would buy things like comic books and candies and toys and treats and things for him, but didn't really know him until I was quite a bit older.
Wow. So we have kind of a culture or a pattern kind of established in this conversation already of when things don't really fit, how do we approach our family in that way? So I'm kind of wondering about my grandma, your mom, and, she, you mentioned to me earlier today when you're preparing for this conversation that she kind of struggled when y'all didn't do what she was expecting necessarily. Mm-hmm. How did she kind of respond to things that were unexpected?
Yeah, it was hard for her. She wanted a perfect little family. Her family had not been perfect, but she wanted us to be something that we weren't or couldn't be, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I think that was hard for her.
Interesting. So on your dad's side of the family, they had this skeleton in the closet that only came up for you in college, and I only learned of it a few years ago about Grandpa being adopted and kind of restructuring the family tree on the fly. Mm-hmm. And then you have the story with Grandma and her brother, and then Grandma's kind of expectations for what her family, you and your brothers and sisters, mm-hmm. would or should be like. So that sounds like a lot of pressure. I would just want to step into this story real quick. I was reading this fable called Iron John and some commentary on this fable. And it describes the story of a young boy who loses a ball that rolls down into the dungeon. And Iron John, this beastly type creature that the king, the boy's father, had dredged up from a lake, is imprisoned in the cellar. And it's scary. The boy has to go down and he wants to get his ball back. But this Iron John character has the ball in the cellar. And the boy comes up to the gate and Iron John kind of grabs him by the wrist and he says, "Let me go. I want, you know," and he says, "if you want your ball back, you have to go up to your mother's bedroom and steal the key from underneath her pillow." And so some have described this story as a metaphor for the need of every child to, in a sense, betray the trust of the mother or to steal the key from under the pillow of the mother in order to step into independence or into the next stage of life. Do you feel that you ever stole the key from under Grandma's pillow?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. So next question is, you described a 10-year period of your life from about 79 to 89 that was really tough as a result of the story we led with. And I was born in that period. What do you have to say to me about that?
You were a light. You were a light in that 10-year period.
Okay, I just wanted to clear that up. All right. So let's talk about your freshman experience in college. Did you ever have you went off to college after a kind of an idyllic adolescence on the farm, right? Mm-hmm. Yes. How were you feeling going off to college for those first 2 years?
I was excited and ready for my next adventure. I loved high school and I had so many friends and I was looking forward to meeting new people, and I kind of went to school to college by myself, so I was meeting a lot of people there.
And the people who talk about the typical college student experience, they'll say that pretty much everybody will have some kind of a crash and burn type situation their freshman year. Do you have any struggles when you went off to school?
No, I was just really homesick. My first semester, I was very homesick, and I remember it was hard. It was, I knew everyone in town and at home, and it was hard being away at school. Even though I was only 3 hours away, it was difficult.
Right. Now, you went to a junior college, right? So you were getting ready to transfer to another school,
yes.
Right? Okay, so let's get into what happened that summer after your second year at junior college. You're getting ready to transfer to a larger university and move to a larger city, and you're home working for the summer, right?
Yes.
So why don't you tell me a little bit about that summer and what happened?
Yes. Yes, I was working. It was shift work, and it was...
Working at a plastics company,
yeah,
was it?
Yeah, I was in a factory there. And so after shift work, we would all get together and one weekend, we all went on vacation to Jackson Hole. And it was there that I was sexually assaulted. And I was a virgin at the time and didn't really even know what had happened. But I later ended up pregnant. And this was extremely frightening. I didn't want to tell anyone. I especially didn't want to tell my parents because of their expectations. And I avoided even thinking about it for a long time, but I was able to talk to a counselor at the college that I was attending in the fall who gave me a challenge to go home and tell my mom and dad that next weekend. and talked to them about it. She and I had already gone through what the choices were that I had. I knew I did not want to have an abortion. I knew I could not take a child at the time. And so we determined that this child would be placed for adoption. I remember going home and telling my parents and how difficult that was because they had such high expectations for me, and it was really out of character for me to be in this situation. And I was feeling very, very depressed and alone and scared.
So for those who don't know, you were going to a private university. You went to Ricks College, and then you had transferred to Brigham Young University, right? So these are places with pretty strict honor codes related to moral conduct, sexual conduct, and a lot of rules around that. How would a sudden, unexpected pregnancy, what kind of implications would that have for your standing as a student?
Well, that's something I talked with the counselor about, and she told me, don't tell anybody. Just pretend like this isn't happening for a while. Let's get through this first semester.
Did you confide in anybody about that besides your parents?
My roommates knew what had happened, and they were the only ones.
Did the counselor point you to any services, or was it just out of the question?
She did. And we made arrangements that I would go to Honolulu, actually, and I would have the baby there, and she would be a place for adoption there. And at the time, I was told she would go to a family on the island of Hawaii. And I felt good about all of that. And anyway, I later found out that's not at all what had happened.
Interesting. So just to back up real quick, your university counselor arranged the adoption for you?
Well, she was actually a counselor, a private counselor with the church.
I see. Okay. So you went to a counselor that was kind of provided to you through channels related to the church. And she advised you not to talk to anybody about it, but she helps.
Well, she just told me not to let anyone at the university know because I would be kicked out of school.
Okay, so here you had gone to this new school optimistic about your transfer, and was that kind of just that out the window in terms of your life plan?
You know, so much of that I have just put out of my mind. It was a painful time.
So you said it didn't go as expected or as promised. What do you mean
Well,
by that?
I thought that she had been adopted and probably grew up in Hawaii. And I later found out, 27 years later, I found out the truth of what had happened.
Wow. Okay, well, I guess that takes us to act one of the story. Right? So you're a high school teacher now. I'm your son. I had left home for college myself, right? And my little brothers are growing up in your home, and you have a very happy marriage. And you're a successful and dynamic high school teacher. And you had gone to China, right? And tell us a little bit about the adventure you had in China.
Well, I was on an international, kind of an education group. And as we were traveling, getting ready to travel home, we got to the airport and my travel documents had been stolen. So my whole team left me there in this communist country. And I spent the next few days trying to arrange for a new passport, a new visa, new travel documents to get out of the country. And it was extremely stressful and I did a lot of crying. So I had just barely arrived back home where we were living in Orofino when something very unexpected happened. That Friday, after I'd gotten home late Thursday night, I went into school to check my email, and I was catching up on my email when an email came through that said this: "Dear Cindy, I hope you are the person I'm looking for. I was born in Honolulu, Hawaii on March 27th, 1979, and I have reason to believe you may be my biological mother." Keep in mind, this was 27 years later. I assumed that she would never, ever find me. I thought maybe at one time, when she turned 18, she might try to find me, but not 27 years later. And so I kind of hyperventilated. I couldn't cry because I'd cried out in China. But I went into my next door colleague's room, and she said, "Are you all right?" And I said, "Come and read this." And she said, "Are you?" said yes. I am.
You were the mother she was looking for.
Yes.
And so you were in your classroom checking emails. Did you just then have to go right into teaching your next class?
There were no students that day. It was a professional day.
Wow. So how did you process it throughout that day?
Oh, I was in shock and went home and I talked with my husband. He knew. I had told him about the adoption and everything, but really no one else knew except my college roommates and my parents knew, but we never, ever spoke of it. Even when I came home from Hawaii 2 weeks after she was born, we never spoke of it.
Now I have a memory that predates this a little bit of you kind of agreeing to talk to a group at the high school, maybe 6 or 7 years before that, in which I learned kind of that there was this person, this mm-hmm. sister, missing sister of mine out in the wild somewhere.
Yes.
When you had, what was that group you were talking about? That another teacher had invited you to,
yes.
to talk about your experience. I do remember it was a lot of pressure and trying mm-hmm. to decide whether to do that. Or I remember at home, you looked like you were in great distress trying to decide whether to open up about that.
Mm-hmm. It was a panel, and on the panel, there was a woman who had had an abortion, and then I represented a woman who'd placed a child for adoption. And I think the teacher that you had a child in high school. So we were talking about that, and I really don't remember a lot more of the context than that, but it was the first time I'd really mentioned it to anyone.
You were just kind of talking about it in high notes,
yes,
right?
Yes.
But I do remember there was a lot of work you had to do emotionally just
yes.
to agree to be on the panel.
Yes, and it was very emotional for me.
This is different now. You're confronted with your daughter saying, you're my mom and I found you.
Yes.
Wow. So would you call her up right away and say hi? Or how did you process that? You know, did you run away from that invitation? Or how do you
yes.
react? How do you react to that?
Yes. She said, I'm not looking for anything from you, just some medical information. If you're willing, I'd like to talk to you. And I held on to that for at least 2 weeks because I was unsure if this is something I wanted to do. And then, of course, I was looking online. I mean, this was 2006, so there wasn't the social media we have today. But I was trying to find anything I could, and I found that she worked at a school. And I thought, well, that's interesting because, you know, I'm a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And so I became curious. The entire time, my husband encouraged me to talk to her. He encouraged me to reach out to her. And later, he actually, when I was with a group of students in Washington, D.C., he called her and invited her to come and visit us at our home. I couldn't believe it. But looking back, I'm glad he did.
So he went out on that limb without talking to you about it.
He did.
Wow. What, and you were just, how did you respond to learning that he had done that?
Well, it was the whole thing was very difficult. And in the middle of all of this, you were getting married.
Yes.
And we were welcoming this beautiful.
Don't forget about me.
Yeah. We were welcoming this beautiful daughter-in-law into our home. And I remember that at your dinner that night before the wedding, I remember you said that your wife was uncomfortable, your wife-to-be was uncomfortable with having this woman, my daughter who had just found mm-hmm. me, show up to meet our family.
Yeah, and she's since said that she was, I don't know, embarrassed about that, I guess. It's understandable. Any bride-to-be, the night before mm-hmm. your wedding, it's your big day the next mm-hmm. day, and you have this stranger, this skeleton in the closet of this family is going to just come on the scene. And,
yeah.
And also, she kind of wanted to be invited to the wedding ceremony.
Yes.
So, of course, we were just kind of like, no. You know, nice to meet you, but
yeah.
let's not jump in too deep.
Yeah, my daughter Jacqueline thought this would be a great way for me to meet the family. I'll just go to their wedding and, you know, meet everyone there. And
right.
Yeah.
You'd mentioned that you spoke with a church counselor, a church leader about, mm-hmm. you know, whether to step into this relationship or not.
Oh, yes. So when I found out that she was coming with her husband, she was 27 years old at the time. She and her husband didn't have any children. And they were coming to visit us there in Orofino. And I remember going in to my local bishop and saying, this is what happened. I have this child. She was adopted at birth. She found me. She's coming to visit this weekend. And I'm in tears telling him this story. And he was also a trained social worker. And he looked at me and he said, well, great. And I said, is it? Is it? I was freaking out because this is a small town we lived in, about 3,000 people. I knew everyone. I was a local teacher. I had a lot of respect. I said, what do I do when we're walking downtown and people walk up to me and I have to introduce her? He goes, you just tell them this is my daughter, Jacqueline. And he said, they won't say anything to you. And they didn't.
Great advice.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, bringing her in to the Sizzler that night. So I had already read through all the emails you had printed off for me. And I remember the long drive from Northern Idaho down to Utah. I just read emails the whole way. And I was just melting, learning all these things about my long-lost biological sister. What kind of music she liked, what were her professional interests, her quirks. And I remember as I would read things I felt like we had in common, mm-hmm. I just started sobbing, thinking it was something very supernatural I was experiencing, the feeling that we were tied together through the universe in some some crazy way. It was interesting that, she turns out she's an AP high school teacher, just like you.
Yes.
And, she looks so similar to you. And even later, now we know that certain mannerisms. Mm. So you can't help but wonder about what are the natural elements, the genetics that tie us together.
Yes.
I was feeling so much of that, thinking, this can't be coincidence, Later, I kind of thought, well, I guess 2% of the American population are teachers. So it's what we make of it, but it's our story, right? So, yeah.
After we met, and one interesting thing, when she came to visit, I hadn't told anyone in my family about her or that she was coming. I told you kids, mm-hmm. Zach and Tate at the time, they were, 9 and 10, I think. Mm-hmm. I said, we set them down and we said, okay, boys, this is the deal. You have a sister, da da da. And they go, oh, that's cool. Can we go out and play now?
Yeah.
They were just like, no big deal, And Wayne and I were so freaked out about it. But on the way to the airport, I had the little boys in the car and I pulled over to the side and called my mother. And I said, Mother, she found me and I'm going to pick her up right now. That's all I said. I hadn't talked about her in 27 years. And my mother said, I knew she would.
So what about those expectations that Grandma had for this kind of tidy family? Had she gone on her own journey, or how did she get to a point where she can say that?
Yeah, I think I found that interesting too, Will. It wasn't easy the way Jacqueline found me because, and this is how it differed from what my expectation was of where she was living. Her parents had come to Honolulu. They were on their way to American Samoa, and they asked if there were any babies to adopt there. And someone said, well, we had a baby that was going to be adopted to the Big Island of Hawaii, but that's fallen through. And they said, well, we want to take her. So they had to stay there in Honolulu for 2 weeks with her, and they took her to Samoa. Actually, no, not American Samoa, the other Samoa. So the records were in New Zealand. So the adoption records were in New Zealand. That's why Jacqueline could never get hold of the adoption records when she had tried to earlier. She actually found out about our family in the craziest way. She was in a carload of girls. She was a leader of these young women. And she and another leader were taking them somewhere, and they were talking about their mothers and if they looked like their mothers. And they said, well, what does your real mother look like, your birth mother? And she was telling them what she'd heard, which was actually not right. But anyway, she said, and I heard that my mother grew up in this place called Downey, Idaho. And the woman with her said, well, my mother lives in Downey. We should call and see if she knows anything about her. And she said, well, I think my mom saw an adoption paper that said this name, Petterborg or something like that. And she goes, well, I'm going to call my mom and see if she knows anyone like that. So this woman called her mother who lived in that town, and her mother had gone to my mother for massage. My mother was a massage therapist. She knew my mother. So this woman who was in the car with Jacqueline said, I'm going to call your biological mother's mother and see what she says. I'm going to pretend I'm going to be an old roommate from college. So she called my
clandestine
mother.
Operation.
Yes. She called my mother while I was in China. She told her where I lived, my email address, my phone number, how many kids I had. Oh, my goodness. She told her everything. And that's how Jacqueline found out where I was. I found out later that after her family was in Samoa, they moved back to Utah, and she was raised 1.5 hours from where I lived.
Yeah, from where you grew up, you mean, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's wild because, you know, I got married and then we were living in Salt Lake City. Mm-hmm. And turns out this long-lost sister of mine was how far is that? Like 15 minutes away?
Yeah, not far.
So that was just crazy.
I know.
Just crazy. Here she is, very similar demographics, right up the road.
That's so crazy.
We met at the Sizzler that night and it was like, hey, welcome to the family. I mean, somehow along the way, our family became extremely open and inclusive, and everyone has their own baggage. And our family became very good at welcoming whoever got dragged into the summer get-together. Oh, this is your ex-husband, not even related anymore, and just got out of prison? Oh, great. Well, join the party. Good to see you again. So that's a beautiful thing, I think, that our family was at a place where, you know, this person who was put away, essentially, ostracized in a way, and a dark shadow can come show up at a Sizzler and just join the party. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the family.
Yeah, I think that's the real positive thing that has come from this. You know, for me personally, it was like a burden had been lifted off my shoulders to be public about it. And actually, it was several years ago when you encouraged me. I was giving a speech at the Concordia Law School program, and I had thought about talking about my story with Jacqueline, and you encouraged me to tell the story publicly. And I remember there was a whole room full of people. My mother was there, my husband, our kids, you, your family were there. And I kind of told the story about Jacqueline. Afterward, a local reporter came up to me and asked if he could have someone come to meet me to tell the story, and it was published in the local newspaper. That went statewide, and I had people reaching out to me from years and years ago, from miles away, talking about their own stories and how they were glad that I had shared that. And I just feel like this whole experience, I mean, this whole lifetime, that it all came full circle. And I realized the importance of this openness in your family and having, not having secrets, but being able to share things that you experience and talk about them. And you're really good at that. Your generation has taught me and the rest of my generation better how to do that.
Interesting. Just so to make sure we paint the clear picture here, I was managing your political campaign. That was the context in which you were giving these remarks, mm-hmm. these public remarks. And, you know, a campaign manager needs to vet all the skeletons in the closet of their candidate, right? And so, you know, I knew that this was a part of our family story and it hadn't been addressed super publicly. So, I mean, I'd like to say that it was 100% motivated by me just saying, like, you need to process your trauma and share it and talk through it. But, you know, the truth is it's a mix of all those things. And that put you and me both and our whole family a little bit ahead of schedule, I think, in terms of when we were comfortable addressing all this. And I think there's something to be learned there maybe about taking a step into the unknown. It took you, I think, a lot of courage to step onto the stage and just be transparent about a deep, deep trauma.
Yes, I think you're right about that. And you're right in that. It was premature to what, because we had talked about how that would come up maybe in the political campaign and how we would address it, but we put it out there early.
Yeah.
And then having that newspaper reporter do the story and allowing that, I just can't say enough about how liberating that was. You know, really just having carried that weight all those years and hiding it for so long. You know, the first people I told when Jacqueline found me were my college roommates. And it wasn't long after that we all got together and they got to meet her, because every year one of them sent me a card on her birthday just saying, hey, how you doing? I'm thinking about you today. For 27 years she did that.
So they were carrying their own version of that traumatic experience.
They were.
So it kind of liberated them from that as well.
Absolutely.
yeah, everybody could talk about it.
Yeah.
And you've talked a lot about, you know, self-actualization and what it means to feel like you're your true self. Mm. You know, because for all those years,
yeah,
it wasn't a ghost or a cloud, but how would you describe that, living with that secret versus coming out in the open?
Well, you know, I think this is kind of a layered issue, because on the one hand, I felt so much guilt about the sexual assault, and I really didn't come to grips with the fact that it wasn't my fault until only a few years ago, honestly. And so I carried that, and I remember thinking, all right, I eventually had 3 sons. I never had a daughter. Why didn't I have a daughter? You know, my daughter, the only daughter I had, I gave her away. And so dealing with some of those feelings and just coming to grips with the fact that, no, that was not my fault. It was a decision that was made. Jacqueline was raised by a beautiful set of parents who had adopted other children. She has a wonderful family. And we are dear friends to this day. I mean, we're still navigating, you know, kind of what our relationship is. I think you're doing the same too, right?
Yeah.
With your biological sister. Mm-hmm. But it's just created this beautiful layer to our family to have a blood relative brought in. And then now she has her 4 children and what that means when we all get together.
Yeah, it's interesting to see what kinds of things we have in common and what we don't have in common. And in a way, it's a privilege to be able to choose how much to get involved in the different aspects of each other's lives.
Yes.
You know, you grow up with siblings. I mean, it's kind of funny. I have 4 half-siblings. I didn't really grow up with any of them. and maybe that's a day for another recording. But, you know, it's a privilege to be able to say, maybe here's my biological family and here's some of the messed up stuff maybe that I don't want to be a part of. And here's all the good, great stuff I want to celebrate and propagate and perpetuate. Yeah. So that's really interesting, you know, and we don't have to like the same kinds of food as Jacqueline. We might, but we don't have to, you know. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to explore those dynamics together.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You mentioned that, you know, coming into this authentic version of yourself that was highly publicized all of a sudden brought a lot of people to you. Do you see yourself as a role model for people navigating sexual assault or trauma recovery or anything like that?
Well, that's interesting that you asked that. I don't consciously think about that, but I know over the years as I taught high school, the last 10 or 12 years, 15 years, I told this story about Jacqueline and how she found me and how that was a lens through which I saw the world. And I shared that with my students, and I found that they then shared with me so much of their lives and so much of the lens through which they saw the world. And then whenever they were having any kind of issues, private, personal issues, they would often come to me for advice or help. And it means a lot to be able to share my experience with them and help them in however I can.
That's great. So what would you say to a young person who maybe just experienced sexual assault on a college campus or during the summer break, who might be experiencing some of these feelings of shame or ostracism or fear? You know, what advice do you have for them on how to navigate that?
You know, one of the things that's actually been interesting for me to navigate too is the whole Me Too movement. And it brought back to me the feelings that I'd had then of not being believed and not being able to talk about it at the time. And I had a lot of friends who, when Me Too was just starting out, they said, well, these women, they're making accusations against men and this and that. And I remember saying to them, let me tell you my story. Let me tell you what it's like to be a woman who's been assaulted and not believed or not want to talk about it because you're afraid that people are going to question you. So I think that was very significant for me to go through that and then to be able to share that with friends of mine who had not had any kind of experience in that way.
Yeah, I mean, to each his own. And the, you know, dealing with trauma, you have to go by feel, probably. I'm not a professional in that area, but I would say the openness and the transparency and the sharing that we experienced throughout this whole journey has been nothing but beneficial. Yeah. The open family culture, the inclusiveness. And sometimes you're not going to meet with that openness and inclusiveness. We talked about some experiences in the past with our family, putting people away or ignoring or bottling things up. But it seems like those things tend to come back full circle in a negative way. So
yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, we were at a family reunion this summer together, and it was my father's family, and he and all his siblings had passed away. And some of us cousins, we were talking, we wish so much we had more information about the story of my dad and his biological mother and what happened, but they never would talk about it. It was kept secret, and they hid it away, and now we don't know anything about it. So I think really something for us to get from the story, a principle for us to gain, is absolutely what you're talking about, the openness and transparency of it.
Yeah. Thanks very much for sharing what can be a painful part of your life, but also, you know, I think there's a silver lining on this, and hopefully we can continue to learn from this person, Jacqueline, who stepped into our lives, and love you. Thanks for sharing all that.
I love you. Thank you.